911, what's your emergency?
Help, there's a man coming down my chimney.
Okay, you're never gonna believe this, but...
That'll do
okay.
It, I guess.
We have exactly what we need. And that only took us 15 minutes to think of a joke.
You know, it's not always easy, okay?
It's not always pretty
behind the scenes.
Comedy is hard, right?
Being
hysterical, comedy legends, icons, and, you know, dare I say, messianic figures within this fandom.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tough road. And it's one that we've chosen for ourselves.
And we dedicate our lives to things like coming up with a funny opening joke, even if it's not that funny and doesn't make that much sense.
We do. Like, I would give my life for the right opening joke. This is serious to me. This is a condition.
And I appreciate that so much about our collaboration. But well, welcome back to the First Risk Podcast, everybody. The only podcast hosted by real comedians.
That's not shade. We love our fellow podcasters.
It's just the truth. Okay.
It's just the truth.
Even though neither of us are comedians. Today, we are discussing the remainder of the season four opening. Season four, episode two, Alone Together. Directed again by David Grossman, written by Lindsay Beaulieu, with Nadia Abbas Madden and Taylor Wong credited as staff writers this time.
This is a very good sign of like the up and ups of Lindsay's career writing for the show. And I was very impressed by what I saw in this episode from a writing perspective within the context of the show. I thought it was very well done. I enjoyed it immensely. I was feeling it. Jane, you were feeling it perhaps even more so than I was.
I was feeling it maybe a little too much at times. You guys, I was moved to tears by this episode. And it happened
multiple different times.
Yeah, and I want you to know it wasn't like, my eyes are welling up a little. It was like all of a sudden I had tears running out of both eyes. And I was like, how did this happen? But I think that's good news. You know, maybe season four is what it took to get us more emotionally engaged in the show again.
Did anything in season three properly move you to tears? I think the closest I got was when Buck had to tell Eddie that he lost Chris in the tsunami. I think that's the closest I ever got in season three.
I thought you were very moved by the old man episode.
Oh, yeah. I was moved, but I wasn't weeping.
You didn't cry when Buck paraded that old man out like an old dog getting to eat steak on its last day before being put down?
No, it was like me sort of reverently looking back and being like, that's nice. I was just appreciating it.
Right.
And thank God someone appreciated that moment.
We just got a comment on that episode from somebody being like, yeah, I thought it was super cringe too. I agree with Jane. Shout out to that person.
Well, excuse me, we also have a couple of other things to address because we also got a comment on our most recent episode. Someone going, oh no, this was recorded before the reveal. Guys, I just want to say how excited I am for the season 9 premiere.
Oh.
Because in space, no one can hear you call.
I mean, am I kind of excited in a, like, jump the shark way? Sure. And also, this is the classic death knell of a franchise is,
oh, yeah.
Well, we're all out of campers for Jason Voorhees to murder, so let's just send him to fucking space, you know?
Hey, James Bond survived it after Moonraker, and Moonraker is one of the best James Bond films in the entire series. Do not come for me, commenters. In this essay, I will. However,
well, that's kind of different because they get to like reboot the franchise whenever they want. This is
true.
One singular TV show.
Imagine if Meredith had to do zero gravity
surgery. You know, credit where credit is due to Grey's Anatomy because they've been on for like more than twice as many seasons as 9-1-1, and no offense, but they never sent anybody to space as far as I can remember. Watch somebody comment and be like, I can't believe you forgot about season 16, episode 12, where they send April into space or something.
What's April doing up there? She doesn't belong there. She's from a farm.
You know, they needed somebody. I'm very curious to find out why one singular LAPD field sergeant was required for whatever this space mission is, but I guess we'll find out.
And one LAFD officer, because we know Hen is going with her. It's a girls' trip.
One LAFD paramedic, yeah. I'm very curious. We'll see.
Very curious.
But anyway, I guess we'll find out soon. Why don't we get into this episode?
I can't believe you're going to be in London at the film festival when Athena is literally going to space.
Yeah, maybe that'll help provide some interesting contrast artistically. You know, I'll be seeing all these wonderful festival films, and then I come home and watch an episode of We Sent Angela Bassett to Space because we're completely out of any other ideas.
So this episode that we're discussing today is set entirely on Earth. It's called Alone Together, which
we already said
for the record is also the name of the Drag Race COVID reunion during season 12. It was okay. Alone Together. So a little COVID continuity there. Ryan Murphy, I see you. I see your behind the scenes machinations. And I'm calling you out. We open on... seemingly real life newsreel footage of LA landslides and flooding.
I think they did this during the earthquake too. Yes, we're seeing a bunch of like stock footage and apparently real documentary footage of real disasters and floods, which always feels a little tasteless, but like I get it. How else are you supposed to represent a news report on one of these things? We're just hearing an anchor kind of tell us about the dam break.
Mm-hmm. And then we cut to we cut
well,
to
we get
a,
an absolutely a, iconic okay. I Feel the Earth Move needle drop.
I Feel the Earth Move by Carole King from Tapestry, one of the best albums of all time. And the Hollywood sign is pre-destruction. It is pre-destruction in the Hollywood Hills. and we see these, so these three people, two guys and a girl, they are hiking up the desolate hills beneath the Hollywood sign. I don't know how big this mountain is. I don't know what it's like to walk in there. It doesn't sound pleasant, especially because you know it's hot out. And we find out just through this conversation, because they're squabbling, there's this one guy who's leading the pack saying, we got to go to the Hollywood sign, and they're like, we have to go home, because they're from Albuquerque, New Mexico, the place where High School Musical was set. Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Exactly.
And they are in LA on vacation. And they have to get home tonight because I don't know, they want to.
They're filming High School Musical tonight.
They are. They're actually auditioning for High School Musical, the musical, the series.
Exactly.
And so they have their little quarrel, and it's kind of like a fun little mix because it's an interesting dynamic.
Yeah.
It's a guy, his girlfriend, and his roommate. And during COVID, she also moved in. And so there's just like a lot of tension in what's known as the quarantine.
Go quarantine. Yeah,
go quarantine.
The roommate guy is seemingly upset that, you know, the other guy, the boyfriend, didn't really discuss the girlfriend moving in with them before letting her do it. It sounds like it might have been one of those kind of hasty move-in situations due to COVID. And, you know, the boyfriend is like, well, what was I supposed to do? Like, it was a lockdown order or whatever. And the other guy is like, I don't know, you could have FaceTimed or Skyped. And he starts listing all these different, like, video call platforms, including two I had never heard of. One is WebEx and one is BlueJeans. Have you heard of these?
No, I have not. And what is that weird social media platform that was around for like 2 minutes that Buck mentioned in season one? What was it?
Oh yeah,
a Marco Polo. Right.
Marco Polo. Everybody who's on Marco Polo was on Blue Jeans, presumably. apparently it was
Blue
a Verizon.
Jeans work sessions.
Mm-hmm. It was a Verizon cloud-based video conferencing service. And then Verizon decided to close down the Blue Jeans platform in August 2023. So it sounds like that didn't last very long.
Presumably because no one was using it. Sure.
Yeah.
Like, you know, we have Zoom, we have Teams, we have, well, we don't have Skype anymore, but we had Skype.
Skype was so good, and then they got rid of it because nothing good and free can exist anymore. Anyway,
we can never call our oomphies again.
We can never call our oomphies again, or else I'll have to buy a Zoom business subscription. Anyway, he starts listing all of these things, but they finally make it to the Hollywood sign. The guy and girl are kind of fighting, but when she sees the Hollywood sign, she's like, oh, like she forgets everything. They start taking their selfies. Mm-hmm.
There's choppers circling, yes. Police choppers, news choppers, and they're like, this is unusual. What's going on here? We shouldn't be here. Let's just take a quick selfie and leave. And then the landslide brings them down. Oh boy, yes. It brings them down hard.
Yep.
So the Hollywood sign comes down, as we saw in the last episode.
What I meant to say about the young people having the landslide bring them down is, in the last episode, I said that I would love if this storyline somehow crossed over with the part of the movie The Kissing Booth where Jacob Elordi and Joey King fuck on the Hollywood sign. And watching this group of young people like have to navigate the landslide on the Hollywood sign, I was like, well, this is pretty similar. You know, we've got like a romantic thing.
Hold on. To clarify, do they fuck on the Hollywood sign or beneath the Hollywood sign?
I think beneath. They don't like literally climb up onto one of the letters.
Because that's like a Lana lyric. Like, we climb up the H of the Hollywood sign in these stolen moments. The world is mine.
Guys, what's the sexiest letter on the Hollywood sign to fuck on? I think it's the Y or maybe the
okay.
W.
One no, of those do not letters? Say the Y, Jane. Do not say the Y because I was looking into some history of the Hollywood sign and I found out some things that I'm gonna share later.
Okay, well, that's ominous. But yes, we then cut to Athena.
Just don't say the why.
We see Athena. We kind of just see the end of the previous episode where she jumps into the house with Sylvia, our agoraphobic woman. The landslide brings them down, and then we get our title card.
And they are in trouble. Double, toil and trouble.
They're in trouble. And may I just say, this doomed Yuri, low-key.
Okay. Because there were sparks.
There were sparks aplenty flying throughout this episode. I was like, ooh, I see a little rare pair brewing here.
Oh, and Jane, you know I love a rare pair. But the less said about that,
right?
The better.
Sylthena. Sylthena moment.
Sylthena moment. We're going to have a lot of those this episode. miraculously, they're, mm-hmm. they come to in the yes. the crumbling ruins of the home, precariously wedged on the side of the cliff. And they're both, like, fine. Like,
they seem pretty okay.
Yeah, and Sylvia is like she's like aware enough to be like, this is why I don't leave the house. Bad
Which,
things
okay,
happen.
Okay, paramour.
Right? And then Athena's over here like, girl, you were in the house when this happened. Like, you had nothing to do with this. Sylvia doesn't have a cell phone because she doesn't have friends. She doesn't know anyone in her life. She stays home. She's a hermit. We've established this. Athena. Oh,
poor Sylvia.
Athena left her phone in the car and she lost her radio, her walkie-talkie.
Rookie mistake.
In the fall. And so they got to find a way to signal for help because, you know, unlike a certain other disaster, at least this time help is coming.
True. As far as we know, help is coming. She's mm-hmm. like, there are helicopters all over the place. I just need you to motivate yourself to do this with me. We then go to the 118 arriving on the scene, and they're kind of getting direction from whoever, like the incident coordinator or whatever. And there's a great line where they're like, where do you want us? And she says, the Hollywood sign, which I was just like marveling at the camp of this episode and everything I love about it. They say something about like the sign having been compromised when they notice the H is missing. And they say that there are some people stuck up there.
Stuck.
Some people trapped up there, this trio of youngsters. And Chimney says, should have bought a vowel.
They should have bought a vowel. He's already making dad jokes. But before he even says that, Buck says to me an even funnier line, because he looks up at the Hollywood sign, which is in shambles, and he goes, mm-hmm. Where's the rest of it?
Yeah.
I love this. This episode is so good. I can't.
This episode is good. There's a lot of humor in it. I love that he feels the need to ask that. It's like, what do you think happened to it, Buck?
And so, you know, Bobby, he has Chim and Buck on shovel duty, digging through the mudslide to try and recover any people that they can, while he, Eddie, and Hen go and investigate terror at the Hollywood sign.
Terror at the Hollywood sign. That'd be a great name for this episode.
That would be, actually. That would be. Let's write that down. And, you know, Hen makes a passing quip about like, hey, you know, that's your karma for bad jokes. And Chimney's like, dad jokes. I'm going to be a dad. I'm playing it cool. I'm getting into the spirit of it. I'm not freaking out about it at all. No anxiety, right. No dread about what a horrible father I'm going to be. I'm just a cool dad, you know? And then we go
everyone.
To the dispatch, and it is pandemonium.
Yeah, where May and Maddie are not even trying to do their jobs.
Not even trying. The entire place is in disarray. It is chaos. It is mayhem at the mm-hmm. dispatch. Abracadabra, abra-ooh-na-na. And they're just there, like, doing little
watching the computer, damn TV.
Watching the damn TV.
No one wants to work anymore.
I'm always saying this. We said that so many times last episode. I'm gonna make a vow not to say that, like, for the foreseeable future.
I think it's always funny. They are watching the news on TV, and May actually spots her mom's squad car and mentions she may have used the CAD to check on her mom before, because, you know, this is kind of a lot to be happening on May's like first day.
Okay, no, hold on, because Maddie is sitting right there. Tell her about it, you know?
Well, true. But I mean, yeah. No, I was going to say, like, well, May's mom is on the job. And then I was like, well, Maddie's brother was on the job. It's not that different. Yeah, but Maddie decides that they'll check on Athena, and they're not getting anything from her. So that worries May, obviously. But Maddie's like, try not to assume the worst. And she actually brings up the earthquake. She's like, she's like, not to be outdone. She's like, well, my first day, there was a 7.1 earthquake, and I made it through that, bitch, so you can make it through this. And she actually repeats the very same advice that Josh gave her about, like, mm-hmm. we all have people we love out there. The best we can do for them is our job.
Yeah. And May, this isn't sitting well with her. She's clearly beside herself with fear for her mother's safety. And I get it. I get it, girl. You know, it is a tough spot to be in, but we don't get to linger on it, because in the ruins of what was presumably once a thriving neighborhood in the Hollywood Hills, Buck and Chimney are shoving through the mud with shovels in mm-hmm. hand, yelling out 118 or LAFD. Is anybody here? Is anybody in
they're
danger?
Just yelling LAFD. They're not just yelling 118 into the emptiness,
118!
Expecting anyone to know what that means.
Yeah, and they find something. So first of all, I just want to say the set design here is fantastic.
Yeah, really cool.
It's really cool because you see just like this really gross, muddy ground that's completely swallowed this neighborhood, and like poking up through the mud, you see lampposts, you see roofs and chimneys and like yard decorations and like presumably stuff from the inside of houses, just like debris everywhere.
I hadn't even really thought about it in terms of a production design perspective, because I think it was so immersive that I in my brain was just sort of like, yeah, this is a real flooded town. But now looking at this, I'm like, oh, people had to build like just the tops of houses to be sticking out of the mud, and that's so creative and fun.
It looks like, so expensive. It looks so well done. It's really captivating, and it really puts you right in there. I will say this is my absolute nightmare scenario, because it is hot in LA, and it was a bright day. It is a bright early autumn, late summer day with not a cloud in the sky. It is blue. It is muggy. It is muddy. Gross. And I can't even go into my house, into the AC, to get out of it.
Well, consider this. If you were in your house when the mudslide hit, being buried under the earth would probably be like the best natural AC, because, you know, it's cold underground.
That's true. That's true. Insulation.
You'd probably be nice and chilly.
Yeah, I'd probably be chilling down there, and they'd come and be like, you have to get out of there. I'm like, why? This is perfect.
But Chimney and Buck come across a rather scary sight. There's like a almost fully buried car with its almost fully buried driver next to it. And they check the guy's pulse and he's dead. So it kind of raises the stakes. We found our first body. And like you were saying with the production design, I feel like this is an effectively kind of haunting image of like just this guy almost totally buried in the mud. It's very...
The reveal, the hand sticking out of the mud and everything. It's like a sort of a slow...
Yeah, it's very kind of chilling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's really... It's so good. You get like the real feeling of like total desolation.
Did you ever watch that episode of Bones where Bones and I think Hodgins are like buried alive in a car?
Yes, yes. Oh, I love that episode. That episode's so right? fucking good. Oh,
that's
my
an
God.
Iconic episode. I remember watching that one as a kid, and it freaked me out so bad, because like when you're a kid and you think about being buried alive, you're like, that's the scariest shit I've ever heard
they
of.
They have to use the airbag to like get more oxygen. Ugh. And then they like overload it and like blow through the fucking windshield and dig themselves out.
They set off a little explosion to alert. Ugh. And the thought of like they totally would have been buried forever had they not done that right at the same moment that everybody came looking for them fortuitously. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it reminded me a little of that.
Amazing
of that
TV.
Of claustrophobia of like, wow. Imagine being buried in your car under the ground.
Yeah. I personally would have just Kill Billed that shit. I would have just, you know, just taken care of that situation.
Of course. We can't all be you, Ryan.
Exactly. I'm just built different is what I'm saying. Speaking of, I don't know, people being buried alive in unfortunate circumstances, what do they hear when they're calling LAFD? They hear... The soft wails of a baby? Oh, no.
Yeah, that's a little bizarre.
That's gonna up the ante.
It was almost feeling like a callback to the baby in the walls. Like,
okay,
you're just
I'm so
randomly
glad.
Hearing this baby crying in such an unexpected place.
I'm so glad you referenced that, because they hear the baby crying and they go like following the cries. And I wrote down in my notes, hey, Buck, if that baby dies, it's on you. how the turntables.
Mm-hmm.
And they find the source of the crying, and it's a baby monitor.
Yes.
But it's not the baby. And it's in a debris pile that's presumably come from a exploded house or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, where is the kid? And you get this great zoom out, like bird's eye shot of the entire fucking mud submerged neighborhood. It's so good. Oh, my God.
It's funny. I know in the last episode I said like the only thing that worried me is like, oh, this episode kind of had a lot of exposition. It was kind of just a lot of like laying the groundwork. And then I was so satisfied with how much action and payoff this episode gave us in response.
Yes, I totally agree. Listen, it's a lot of, you know, you have to lay a lot of groundwork in order to bury a neighborhood in mud.
So true. Literal
like literally,
groundwork.
Literal groundwork.
We go to Bobby and Hen and Eddie traipsing through up to the Hollywood sign. And Bobby starts randomly rattling off this fact about, you know, this isn't actually the first time the Hollywood sign has fallen. Because apparently legend has it that one time, like years ago, this drunk groundskeeper accidentally crashed his car into the H. And everybody's like, how do you know that? And he says he once took a tour of the hills first moved to LA.
This is so a story that like a city tour bus driver would tell, because the real history is actually very documented and known of the Hollywood sign. So, guys, please indulge me, if you will, because I did some light Wikipedia searching.
You're telling me Bobby is a liar?
I'm telling you Bobby was lied to.
Okay.
Which is that the Hollywood sign has a long storied history of decay and restoration, because it made its grand debut during the golden age of cinema to promote burgeoning Hollywood studios in LA, and B, the Hollywood Land residential area. And so the original sign said Hollywood Land, and it was made out of a different material. I think it was like a wood or something like that. And the thing about, you know, the material that it was made of is that it decayed and crumbled very easily. It very quickly became a massive eyesore. There were periods in which the H crumbled entirely and fell off. There was a period in which the O, one of the O's, crumbled and decayed as well.
Aww. So it just became Hollywood.
Hollywood. Hollywood. And they took off the, because the original sign spelled Hollywood Land, and in 1949 they restored the sign because it was crumbling and an eyesore, and we had just finished World War II and had a lot of money again, and so they took off the land and they made it Hollywood and they restored it. That restoration period didn't last, because guys, the 1970s rolled around, and yeah, they were not taking care of it at all. I mean, like, when I say it was, like, decaying, it was, like, rotting.
Were hippies, like, putting flower crowns on it and, like, painting murals on it and stuff?
One assumes, meanwhile, you know, I don't know, the ghost of Nixon is over here just ranting about something off the record, like, ah, blah, 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 the corruption, etc. And so they decided to start this initiative to completely restore the Hollywood sign. And they built it out of materials that is currently made of steel, that sort of thing. And it was paid for by wealthy donors and patrons of the arts. Each letter on the modern Hollywood sign was dedicated to one of these donors. Warner Bros. Really? Studios has a letter. I believe they're one of the O's. No, they're the W.
Yeah, that would make sense.
And the Y, and this is why, Jane, I say you shouldn't go for the Y specifically.
Uh-oh, who is it?
It's because the Y was paid for by Hugh Hefner.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
It could be worse. I thought you were going to say it was some, like, Nazi who had moved to Argentina or something.
Adolf Hitler paid for the Y in the Hollywood sign. No, it was Hugh Hefner. You guys know that the Playboy Mansion still stands in Los Angeles to this day. And Hugh Hefner, I mean, he's dead now, but he lived for a long time, and he was... He's not a good man. I don't know. Don't Google it if you want to have a good day. But if you do want to Google it, prepare to be mighty, mighty shocked at the things he got away with in his time. A CEO of Playboy. Funny little world we live in. But that's sort of an abridged history of the Hollywood sign. And that's why I just found it very amusing. Bobby's like, legend has it that one time a groundskeeper got drunk and crashed his car into the H and knocked it over off of its axis. Like, guy, come on. I get that you took a tour, but you don't know the half of it.
Yeah, maybe they just figured it was easier to invent this little tidbit than for Bobby to go into this long-winded explanation of how it, like, decayed over time and then was partially restored and then decayed more. And
that's what Buck would have done.
Rebuilt it completely.
Buck was off with Chimney. They couldn't have someone exposit that hard just randomly at everyone else.
Yeah, had Buck been there, that's why, literally that's why they separated them. Buck would have been so annoying about correcting him if he had been there. Anyway, they reach our trio of young people, and immediately we can see, like, two of them, the boyfriend and girlfriend, are, like, cowering up, holding on to the sign, and the, like, annoyed third roommate, the third wheel guy, is stuck in quicksand.
He is literally trapped in literal quicksand.
He says, "Help, I'm stuck." So that's a great moment.
And girl, you know he's stuck because we all know about quicksand. It is, cue the famous John Mulaney bit. We all thought it was going to be a huge problem than it turned out to be. To the point where, like, you know, none of us have ever seen quicksand, right? So when you see it, like, just in, like, sort of the light of day in a modern setting like this, it's like, oh, I forgot that existed. Yeah. It's like whirlpools. Like, I never see whirlpools, but sometimes you can see them beneath, like, the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco, I think. And it's like, what are you doing here?
Hey, you know what a word is for a small whirlpool?
What's that?
An eddy.
Is it really?
Yeah, it comes up a lot in crosswords.
Oh.
E-D-D-Y, though.
Oh, eddy.
So spelled in the step up Eddie Diaz way, not the 911 Eddie Diaz way. But anyway, we go back to Buck and Chimney. They're still searching. You know, they're kind of trying to see if their radio, if they can get this baby monitor to tell them where the kid is. They don't know where the, I think they've got the receiver. They don't know where the transmitter is.
Mm-hmm. And so they have this ingenious idea because they're, they're walking around and Buck makes a quip about find my iPhone. And
yeah, Buck is being the millennial in the situation. They're having him be the youngest character in a way where he's like, why doesn't it just work the way my iPhone works?
And Chimney, we get a little Chimney moment because he's like, he's starting to worry. This lost baby is like, man, I'm totally going to misplace my kid one day. I lose my phone like 3 times a week. I'm going to have to AirTag that little rascal.
Uh-huh.
And they get this ingenious idea because, you know, they took out all the cell towers in the area to help them work, I suppose, and yet they're still getting all this feedback. And so they're going to find the transmitter and by extension the baby by following the feedback, and it's going to turn into find my baby.
Yeah, the battery operated transmitter is like emitting feedback. So yeah, Chimney goes, find my baby. A brilliant new service offered by Apple. Yeah, I don't know enough about radios to know that, but basically, you know, we do a little bit of a time skip. They're searching, and we get a nice, the show nicely knits Chimney's conflict into the sort of adventure that he and Buck are having, where Buck really clocks that Chimney is worried about being a father. And, you know, Chimney has said something about, like, the parents could be dead, this kid could be an orphan. And Buck's like, why do you always jump to the worst case scenario? And they start kind of going at it about that. Buck's like, you're about to have a kid with my sister, and, like, you're still so worried that you won't even move in with her. Chimney's like, you know, I'm justified because the world is so crazy right now. Like, there is a lot to be worried about. And Buck's like, what, are you going to just wait and never move in with her until it goes back to normal? Like, what if the world never goes back to normal? And that's sort of the root of it. It's like, is Chimney going to be a dad over video forever? That's what he says at first. He's like, well, I have experience with that. You know, that's how I was raised. He's being very kind of a downer about this. Buck's like, yeah, I don't know why you're so worried, like you're going to be a great dad. But Chimney clearly has a lot of insecurity about this, which is so sad.
It's so sad. It's so sad. And it's so real, like, to his character, because I feel like it's a very normal, well, it's a very common thing for young parents or parents to be who weren't raised in the most loving or stable households to think, oh, my God, I am going to grow up to be exactly like my father or my mother. You know, I am going to grow up to be exactly like my parents, and I'm not going to do anything differently, even though I promised myself that I would, and I know exactly what they did wrong. I'm still going to repeat all of their same mistakes because that's who I am. I might as well lie down and rot and walk out on my family before they even get to my door.
Yeah.
Before the stork even arrives to drop the baby off.
Somewhere, the ghost of a possible Shannon Diaz backstory is wailing out in the night. But anyway, yeah, that's the anxiety Chimney is expressing. And it's sad also because we have observed Chimney as a character, and like Buck, like, we also are sure that he would be a good dad. And as Buck points out, like, you know, I watch you help people every day and be great with people.
Yeah, if Chimney's father was a firefighter, he would have been better for sure. But then they follow the feedback until it is, I don't know, blistering or whatever. They're like, this, they're so sure this is the right house. Mm-hmm. And it is, oh, y'all, it is submerged. The roof is barely poking out. But, you know, it is poking out. They have an entrance point because they find a chimney.
Yeah, Buck just goes, chimney. And Chimney goes, what? And Buck says, no, the chimney. It's a great moment. It's one we've kind of been waiting for, you know, like, because mm-hmm. how many, there have got to be firefighter situations where you come across an actual chimney. So yeah. Hilarious.
You have to wiggle your way down the chimney like goddamn Santa Claus. I am so here for this. I am so no, here same. For it. So and I am so happy that this is happening because it's a good way to inject some sort of campy levity into this like nightmare scenario while they're also dealing with these horrible yeah. anxieties about their personal lives. Like, that's what I love about this show. That's what I love about all of these shows in the Ryan Murphy right. verse, is that they balance sort of the camp absurdity with genuine human emotions.
Yes.
So that's I was feeling this. Then we cut back to
Sylphina.
Sylphina, Athena finds her radio.
Yes, they're trying to kind of climb towards the sunlight in the crushed house, but luckily Athena comes by her radio as she's doing this.
Maddie picks up the call when Athena radios dispatch, and May is there like, oh my god, my mom's alive. Yay.
Time to abandon whatever work I was doing.
Right, no, exactly. Like, hi, sorry, could I actually put you on hold? What, my leg is fucking coming off of my body. I'll be right back. And so Maddie starts directing her to her car, because obviously she mm-hmm. can see like where her car is parked. And just as things are looking up for them, ooh, the ground is unstable. It starts shaking. Like tortured Yuri, Sylvia falls into the darkness, into the depths.
Yeah, there's kind of another shift, and the house. Sylvia is now like crushed. She's pinned. She's stuck. Mm-hmm. You could even say she's trapped.
She's a little trapped. I'm not going to lie.
Under like a large part of rubble.
Jane, how is this tortured Yuri sitting for you? Are you getting your life? Are you sort of, are you just really like indulging in it and just really enjoying yourself?
Oh yeah, that's how I felt while watching the episode, certainly. Although we haven't even really got to the best parts yet. So like now I'm just kind of letting it wash over me. Mm-hmm. We go back to this quicksand scene and the firefighters are setting up like pieces of plywood to help support and kind of secure the quicksand area. Mm-hmm. He's not in a great spot because the pressure, the density of the quicksand is like constricting his lungs, and his breathing mm-hmm. is getting more and more difficult. He starts to panic naturally. He's like, this year has been so terrible. My life sucks. He starts arguing with the roommate again about like, whatever, your girlfriend moved in with us.
Eddie makes an attempt at comforting him. Eddie makes an attempt at comforting him because he says he thinks he's going to drown. And Eddie goes, it's impossible to drown in quicksand. Everyone knows that. He doesn't say that part, but it's just like, oh,
it's implied.
It's implied. Idiot. The 118 yeah. is bearing witness to this entire thing. And they're like, can't we just pull him out? And Hen's like, sure, if you want to rip him in half. Jesus Christ.
I'd love to know if that would really happen.
I would love to see it. But anyways, imagine being at work and this is happening around you. Okay, so I was just bartending at my job yesterday, and towards the end of my shift, I had been working like a dog, like the 3 days before mm-hmm. that as well. So I was very tired. I was coming up in the end of my shift. I was closing down the bar, and these two young people, a guy and a girl, were sitting at the bar, and it was very obvious they were on a first date. And this was like the preamble to like the date itself. And mm-hmm. oh my God, I didn't want to have to listen to it, but then I was listening to it and it started getting interesting because this guy, he had moved to Jersey in like January and is working in like, you know, like finance or something. And he's only been to the city like 6-ish times. We're recording this in September, if you didn't know, late September. And this girl, she's living in New York, but she went to school in Boston. I got everything. And so she was asking, so what's the move? And he asks her if she likes museums, and she's like, no, I don't really like museums that much. And he's like, oh. And it became very apparent that he did not have a plan for this date whatsoever. And so I was just sitting there. I was like cringing for both of them. I was like, girl, you can do better.
Or like his one idea had been a museum, and then she revealed that she didn't like museums. Yikes.
And like I was like thinking of ways I could chime in, but the only things I could think of were museums. And so I just stayed silent and I just listened to it.
You just let them crash and burn.
I wish that it was three people arguing in like with this intensity near me so that I at least could enjoy the spectacle of it. Cause I was crawling out of my skin. I just wanted to disappear. And it was the end of my shift too. Like my boss had left for the day. So I had poured myself a little mimosa and I was like, I just want to enjoy my drink. I just want to enjoy my drink while I'm closing the bar. I just want to enjoy my drink.
Well, watching this scene, it does kind of seem like maybe one of the most fun parts about being a first responder is like when you're in these calls that maybe aren't super life threatening, but you just get to hear like all the random drama about somebody's life.
Because Hen is living for it. Hen is getting her life, living for it.
And before the guys really get into it, the guy in the quicksand is still sinking, and they realize they need to get something in there to support him, and they don't really have any like good poles nearby or anything. So suddenly they're like, wait, we can use the H of the Hollywood sign, which again, so amazing. Like, I just love the whimsy of this episode. So they start like sawing apart the H so that they can use it to like stick in the sand and hold him up.
Suddenly, Lana Del Rey, Lust for Life voice again. We saw off the H of the Hollywood sign
and pull you out of the quicksand with it. Suddenly, I think his name is Dylan, the guy who's stuck in the quicksand. Suddenly, he, after having been like arguing with the guy and the girl, he suddenly says to the girlfriend, who it seemed that he like hates the whole episode, he suddenly is like, I love you, I'm in love with you. it's very Love Actually, like that one thread in Love Actually where like Keira Knightley thinks that her husband's best friend like hates her. And
you mean, wait, hold on, you mean Tommy Kennard's favorite movie, Love Actually?
Oh my god, stop, I forgot.
Canonically
Love Actually and Monster Trucks. What
and craft beer,
man.
Don't forget the craft beer. Right.
I'm sorry, I just cringed so that part of Love Actually where Keira Knightley has thought that her husband's best friend is like annoyed at her, hates her for like coming in between their friendship, but in fact then she sees his creepy wedding video he took and she's like, they're all of me. And it turns out he's actually been sort of behaving coldly to her because he's in love with her. So we get this thing, this guy's like, yeah, I've been upset about us all moving in together because it's been torture watching you guys have your romance while I have to just watch. It's so weird.
It's so weird. I mean, it just reinforces what I hate about Love Actually, but...
Right, but, that is like the worst part of Love... Well, not the worst part. The worst part is that guy who like wants to go to Wisconsin to like have sex with loose American women.
I'm sorry, it's not a good movie. I'm sorry. No.
No, but the part at the end always makes me tear up when it's just families reuniting at the airport. Anyway, so they start to pull the guy out of the quicksand. It's like he's getting really, it doesn't seem like that high of stakes for the 118, but the guy in the quicksand thinks he's going to die. So he it's really intense for him. And apparently it's really intense for the girl because all of a sudden she's like, I love you too. Like as it looks like he can't breathe and he's going to die, she suddenly says she loves him too. She starts to reciprocate. They get the H, the part of the H in there. This almost feels like he's giving birth or something.
Is that just association with the rest of the episode? Is that just association?
Maybe, but at this point watching the episode, I didn't remember that there was going to be like a baby delivery later. I was just thinking it's the way they're sort of coaching him through it. And they're like, okay, lean back like you're sitting in a chair and we're going to get this thing under you. And, you know, come on, push, you can do it.
Push.
And they pull him out of the quicksand. And it is kind of like a rebirth, pulling this man out of this wet quicksand. It is a bit like the water of the womb.
He's certainly changed. You know, it's certainly one of those like the dynamics are shifted and won't return to how they were before. I will say it's just one of those moments where it's like the love triangle could so obviously be solved if they just had a three-way. Like, why not just go the bi-poly route? You know, what's wrong with bi-poly? Why can't we bring that into this equation? 911. Oh, because they won't even say the word bisexual. It's fine. It's fine. And so it's like, it seems like she's pretending to love him to, I don't know, get his rage going, his will to live back, and they get him out. And now, you know, he's going to die a horrible death at the hands of his roommate. Neither one of these guys, I will say, no shade to the actors. Neither one of these guys are on her level. She could do so much better than both of them. And the fact that she's settling for both of them, it kind of says something about her. I just want to have like a little, you know, GBF sit down with her and say, girl, you can do so much better.
They
you know,
were fine.
Get out of
guys,
this town.
Whatever. But, yeah. but after
but
the
she,
guy gets
but
out
she's
of the
a stunning
sand,
goddess and neither one of them is up to her level. I'm sorry.
Standards are higher for women. You know how it is.
That's true.
The guy gets out of the quicksand and actually it seems like maybe the girlfriend was kind of being real because, you know, her boyfriend is like, what was all that about? And she's like, I don't know, like his passion moved me and, you know, it was so intense I just felt like I should say it back. It's kind of funny.
Yeah,
these three go about their business. The rescue helicopter is there and it's obviously going to be a very awkward flight back home, so the girl goes up to Hen. She's like, there isn't any way I could get the next flight. And Hen's like, sorry, no.
Maybe, you know what, maybe she can't do better. Maybe this is just like where her personality leads her and like defaults
right.
to at the end of the day.
I
so
feel
maybe,
like they're just all similar people.
Yeah. So we go back to Buck and Chimney. Chimney is getting in position in the chimney. They got the axe and they hacked off the top of the chimney. And now Chimney is going to go down the chimney. And he says to Buck, in the future, if anybody asks, this is how I got my name.
Yep. It's pretty good.
So now I'm like, wait, hold on. Was it a scandal?
No, I think we've always been meant to believe that it was something embarrassing, right?
But like, was it dubious in some way?
Like, I feel like the references to it before have kind of suggested that. I mean, I don't think it was like morally bad, but you know, something embarrassing. I think that's what we've been meant to, because remember in Dosed when somebody asked, you know, Taylor Kelly asked why he was called Chimney and like Hen said, like, that's not a story you can tell on TV. I think it's like embarrassing and somehow not safe for work.
But then do you remember when they were meeting Christopher for the first time and they're like,
right.
do you want to know why
really
he's called Chimney? It doesn't
Maybe
really make sense.
Maybe it's something like bathroom related where it's like a little too like gross to tell on TV, but it's not actually like adult necessarily.
I don't know. I honestly prefer this story to whatever hypothetical one is cooking up in my brain.
Yeah, I guess we'll never know. But Chimney is lowered down into the chimney. He gets inside this house and at first he doesn't see anyone. Until he finds this old woman, like, sitting kind of in a sitting position down on the floor. She's got a head injury. He checks her pulse. She's died. He assumes this is the mom, even though she looks maybe a little older than somebody who would be the mom. At first, you think, oh, maybe this was, like, a grandparents taking care of the baby situation. Mm-hmm. But Chimney, like, radios up to Buck. He's like, I found the mom. She's deceased. He sees a little baby carrier, goes over, sees this sleeping baby. Luckily, it's alive. He gets it to wake up. He's like, I got eyes on the baby.
It's a small baby. It's a couple days old. Like,
it is a small baby. Yeah. Chimney says, like, it can't be more than a few days old. So a fresh baby, fresh out of the oven. Right as Chimney thinks he's, like, seeing the extent of this, he hears a woman, like, crying out from another room. He's like, okay, what's that about? He goes inside this room. These women are saying, like, help, we're locked in. He barges into the room, and it's all these pregnant women one who has just given birth to this baby and is freaking out. She's like, you know, she took my baby. Where's my baby? Is he okay? Chimney's like, your baby. This woman says she took him. You know, she took my baby, said he wasn't mine anymore. So Chimney is slowly realizing, oh, we've got like a Lifetime movie, true crime baby selling factory situation going on, actually.
Yeah, it appears to be a sort of a trafficking operation of some variety.
I think it's like an illegal adoption well, I think that still counts as trafficking. But yeah, I have seen like multiple Lifetime movies about this type of thing.
I've never heard of this before this show. This is a thing?
Well, I don't think it happens like often, but we've got this older lady, the dead lady from Inside. We hear
whose
her name's name? Carol.
No, whose name is Carol, and we heard a Carol King song. So I'm left to surmise that Carol King is trafficking newborn infants in the Hollywood Hills.
No, she
and also
would never.
She died. R.I.P. legend.
Not my Carol King. She would never. Yes, no, she, Carol,
no,
unrelated.
You know why Carol King didn't do it? Because she was so far away from the scene of the crime.
True. And also, I watched with the captions on, and it was actually Carol, just C-A-R-O-L, whereas Carol King, I believe her name has an E at the end.
Right. So instead, it was Carol Hudson. Oh, no.
Yes. She's been on the show in the sense of she's, what was her name? Norman and...
See Me Norman, that lady.
All I remember is See Me Norman. Well, yes, we hear about Carol. We hear that she tricked all these women into giving up their babies. And, you know, it all starts to dawn on Chimney. He's like, you're the mother. And they're like, what about Carol? And he says, like, oh, the, you know, she didn't make it, which I'm starting to feel less bad about.
Yeah.
Great line.
Great line. And we're all there.
He explains to them that the mudslide happened because they're not even sure what's been happening. They're kind of just locked in this house, unable to really see anything. And one of them, he realizes, is actually in active labor. And that's why he heard screaming. So that's a bit of a, you know, throws a wrench into things.
Yeah, so that's going to be a whole situation. Sylvia, back in the tortured Yuri.
Sylvia, sorry.
Sylvia, you're on the run now, running after somebody.
It doesn't quite work the same, but you know.
It doesn't. Sylvia, no, it doesn't hit. It doesn't hit, I'm sorry.
It really helps to have that "oh" sound. Gloria.
Gloria. See me, Norman. Sylvia is under some rubble. Athena finds her. She's trapped.
Girlie's stuck
under some rubble. Oh, and it's like, oh, what if she's dead? Oh, this is gonna be very tortured Yuri. But no, she's alive. She's hanging on. She's keep holding on. And Athena, she asks her if she can move. She's like, no, this is heavy. So she tries to move it, but she can't. It's heavy.
It looks like she's under like a big marble countertop or something.
Something like that. Something heavy. I feel like Athena could handle it.
And she does. Spoilers.
But like, I feel like she would have been able to lift it off herself. I'm sorry.
Yeah, they maybe didn't make it look quite heavy enough. Whatever. It's not that important.
It's fine.
Athena radios dispatch. She says, like, I need to know when those units are coming. This is like getting to be a pretty urgent situation. Maddie says they still don't have them yet. She tells them, like, you know, the structure shifted. We don't have much time. May is listening in on all this. And Sylvia tells Athena, like, don't worry about me. Just save yourself. Just go. Which, again, the Yuri, you guys. Sylvia's like, just save yourself. Just go. May suddenly, very inappropriately as a dispatcher, like, you know, presses into the call. She's like, yeah, mom, listen to her. Get out of there. Fuck this lady. And Maddie, you can tell Maddie's kind of looking at her like, stop it. But May's saying, like, get out of there before you both die. Athena is like, dispatch, May, don't start with me. If you want to help, get that rescue down here now.
Yeah, it's echoing the thing that Maddie said about the best thing we can do for them is to keep doing our jobs. Maddie puts May in timeout.
She puts Maddie, her in timeout.
Maddie puts her in timeout hard. Okay.
She's like, because, go sit in the shame corner.
Go sit in the shame corner and doom scroll on your phone for the next 45 minutes while we figure out what's going on
go,
here.
Go on TikTok or whatever you kids like to do.
Yeah. TikTok was a thing by now. Like for a while, it's been a thing. Oh, wow. TikTok in the 911 universe.
It's 2020 now. May could be like getting totally indoctrinated with conspiracy theories on TikTok right now.
Yeah, yeah. And if she was a Shane Dawson viewer before this, before his whole thing, that also went down around this time, then maybe she was already predisposed.
But what's great is Maddie sends her off and she says, you're done.
And you're done. And you're done.
You're done. So back
she canceled
at the,
May was canceled
she
hard.
She canceled May. May was canceled. And back at the scene of the pregnant woman baby trafficking ring, night has fallen and now they are clearing the roof for extraction. So I guess they're gonna get to these women by taking the roof off essentially, or getting a hole in the roof. But we've got like Bobby is talking to kind of the emergency coordinator or whatever, and she says to him like, first I've got something else I want to brief you on, which we cut away, but you can only assume that that's like, by the way, your wife is stuck in a house with having an intense, possibly lesbian affair with another woman.
Imagine being so clueless watching this, like, I wonder what it could be. They cut away. I don't know.
I mean, they're coy about it.
So he's going to get briefed on the Athena problem. Buck smashes the skylight and descends. Yes. Like the Archangel Michael, to deliver them from their suffering. He has with him a
Speaking
bag
of
supplies. Okay, because the woman in labor, she is gonna give birth like now, and Chimney is gonna deliver that baby with the bag of supplies that Buck has brought.
Yes, and guys, spoilers. This was the scene where I cried for the first time.
I'm so curious what the second time is gonna be. I'm so curious what the second time is going to be.
So I also noted at this point that I was impressed by how much they were able to accomplish simultaneously in a single episode. And I was kind of like mourning the skill of this type of writing, because especially we're only like halfway through the episode at this point. We've still got like 20 minutes left. And I was like, wow, they really used to like weave so many threads together. And I was kind of thinking about the season 8 finale and how it's just like, the first half of the episode, or I don't know, probably like the first 2/3 are like this one dumb emergency with a bunch of characters you don't care. It was lacking the sauce. And this episode had a lot of sauce. So
yeah, I agree.
Chimney is delivering the baby of this woman, Amber, and Amber starts to express her own personal deal. She's like very upset that she's delivering this baby alone. She, you know, Chimney asks about the father. She's like, he doesn't know. He's not a good guy. I didn't tell him. Carol, the evil baby trafficker lady, made it sound like this was my best option and that, you know, I wouldn't be alone together. Yeah. Remember, it's the name of the episode is Alone Together. She's like, she made me think that this would be the only way to like have somebody by my side as I had this baby. And Chimney starts to realize that this situation kind of mirrors his own. Because he's like, you know, we do pretty crazy things out of fear.
And he says 90% of being a good parent is just showing up. You know, that's what they say.
Mm-hmm.
I will say this was very mirroring the setup with these women locked in this house. It was mirroring to me. Did anyone watch that Netflix show The OA? It's one of the best shows I've ever seen, and they canceled it after 2 seasons, and it was supposed to be 5 seasons, and I will die mad about it. But the first season had a setup that was somewhat similar to this, except instead of, you know, harvesting babies from new mothers to sell on the black market, I guess. It was about a mad scientist studying near-death experiences. It was a whole thing. But I just liked that because I just like to talk about that show. But yes, it is mirroring Chimney's anxieties about parenthood. And it's sort of like it's a very extreme example of this, because as you said, you know, she was feeling very alone. You know, her parents kicked her out, the baby's father was not a good guy, she had no one, and there were all these moments during, you know, the first ultrasound, the first kick. She has this almost Shelby Corcoran-esque line where she's like, all I wanted was to sort of like look over and like hold someone's hand during those moments, you know, and to like share that with someone.
That was the part where I cried.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And she's like, I was so lonely. And I'm like, I get it, girl. I get it. I get it. I was really feeling this. It was remarkably well done. There was so much pathos in this.
Good bit actress in this scene. Like, she's really
excellent.
Selling it.
Excellent. And also great writing. Good job, Lindsay. Yeah. I know we've been down on some of your work in the past, but we are big fans.
But listen, season 4 is all about comebacks, okay?
It's a fresh start, okay? We're putting it all in the past. Rage, never heard of her.
Never heard of her.
Didn't happen.
But throughout this scene, we're kind of cross-cutting with Athena and Sylvia, who Athena, in her firefighter era, is like, I'm going to get a big pole to leverage this thing off of you, but it's not really working at first. And we actually start to hear Sylvia's backstory after the very emotional Chimney and Amber part.
Mm-hmm.
We start to see Sylvia explains, she's still trying to make Athena go and leave her. She's like, I deserve this. I am not even supposed to be alive. And we hear essentially she became agoraphobic in the first place out of grief and survivor's guilt. She had been in a car accident with her sister where it sounds like it wasn't her fault at all. Like somebody came out of nowhere and hit them, but her sister died and she didn't. And it led to this whole retreating into the darkness in her life and eventually not leaving the house at all.
So that was also like, it's just like this sort of cross moment between these moments of human connection, people sharing their stories and their pain. Athena relates to her she's flashing back to the night she was attacked by a criminal. And it's hitting a lot of these beats where it's like, this is kind of what the heart of the show is really about, which is sort of like connecting through pain and surviving it and pushing through it to form community. So I was appreciating this. It was really well done.
Mm-hmm.
And so Athena, she gets her wedge to push it off of Sylvia. The baby's coming. And so it's just this moment of push. Push.
Epic. I wrote in my notes, epic emotional cross-cutting between Chim delivering the baby and Athena getting Sylvia out as beautiful string music plays.
Yeah. Second
but that being
greatest.
Said, they second, don't play Bohemian Rhapsody.
I was just going to say, second greatest cross-cutting of a childbirth in a Ryan Murphy show in TV history.
Right.
Eclipsed
second
only.
Greatest.
Eclipsed only.
But yes, there's this beautiful, beautiful scene. The baby comes, she's here, she's perfect. And it seems like this has sort of helped Chimney overcome his hangups. Like maybe he's seeing this newborn baby and thinking about how, like, yes, I can't do things out of fear anymore. I want to be there with my baby and the mother of my child.
Mm-hmm. It's very life affirming.
Yes.
It's very life affirming. And it was very refreshing in this media cycle of doom and gloom and also just abject confusion. Today, El Presidente announced that he was placing a 100% tariff on foreign films, and everyone collectively in the film industry goes, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, what, like the distribution rights or like the Amazon rental fee,
the physical film itself, like, because a lot of these are on digital now.
Sounds like he doesn't know what that means, which wouldn't surprise me.
It was all just words.
I mean, if I were to be hopeful, I would hope that we can just assume that because that doesn't make any sense, it's not going to be enforced remotely, and it'll just be quietly reversed at some point.
Yeah. The baby is born. Beautiful baby girl. Sylvia is free. She gets free. Hey, another Lana song from the same album, actually. Great album, Lust for Life. Go stream it.
She thanks Athena for not leaving her.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, we're going to get out of here together.
And now it's the climb. Yeah, yeah.
I wrote here and I'm crying again. And I think it must have just been like when they got Sylvia out, because I don't think it was about the next scene.
It was just like life affirming. It was very beautiful. And it
we go back to the dispatch and May is doom scrolling in the break room or whatever.
She's so Gen Z. She's just like me. I'm sorry, May Grant. Yeah. I know exactly what you are.
Yeah. Maddie comes in and gives her the greatest, like, stern but loving guidance as a mentor. She's like, you know, I get it, but actually what you did, I get that you were just afraid for your mom's life, but on these calls we're someone else's lifeline, you know, we can't panic because we're the person that the person on the other end has to hang on to. And, you know, I know you were doing this thing out of care for your mom today, but you actually only made the situation worse. You know, May says it won't happen again. Maddie's like, good. And that's that.
And that's it. You know, she's not, you know, penalized for this beyond the stern.
Yeah, she says good because we need you back out there. It's like,
exactly. Yeah. And that's very nice. It's like that's what I feel like a mentor relationship is supposed to be like. Stern but fair. Yes. You know, don't do this again, etc. Now let's get back to work because, you know, people need our help, that sort of thing. They get the woman who just delivered her baby out, or just had her baby, I should say. Chim delivered it. who just had her baby out of the house, and all of the other women, or like one of the other women, was like there waiting for her. She's like, I thought you'd be at the hospital. And it's like, I couldn't leave without you. It's like, oh, she, in some really weird fucked up way, she has a support system now because they're all sisters now.
Well, yeah, it's like she does have some community. She has a friend here. And so you're meant to think, I think, even though there is a really beautiful line, and this was part of the part that I cried at when she and Chimney were having her emotional talk. Chimney said this thing saying, like, you're about to have someone by your side for the rest of your life, you know, implying that her baby is, you know, she can seek love from her kid at least. But yeah, I think this shows us that, like, don't worry about Amber. She's not going to go back to being totally isolated. She has her baby and potentially a friend or two.
Yay.
So that's good.
Yeah. And Carol is dead.
And Carol's dead as fuck. Rest in piss.
Rest in piss. And so then Athena and Sylvia, they yuri their way out of the collapsed house onto solid ground. A chopper is flying overhead. Who should be inside but one Bobby Nash looking for Athena Grant.
Bobby Nash.
They would find each other in any universe.
Looking for his wife.
They would find each other any universe, okay? But
not this one yet.
She waves the flashlight and he can't see her because the flashlight's beam is too weak. Okay, night has truly fallen and there's no streetlights, so it is just like proper veil of darkness on the ground. Athena's wearing her cop outfit, her uniform, and it's all black, so it's like they're not wearing bright colors. They can't be seen. And so Athena, she says, stay here. And she goes to her squad car, and she pops on the lights and the sirens, and she stands on the roof and she waves her arms in the air, and Bobby catches a glimpse and he goes, turn around over there. And he sees her. And oh
yes, that's right. The beacon of the LAPD saves the day.
Jesus Christ. Anyways, they are reunited, and
that's all that matters. They're reunited,
and Bobby and Athena will never be in mortal peril in any season disaster opening or any scenario ever again. And they all live happily ever after. Yeah, that's comforting. May, they get her in the chopper on the way to the hospital. Presumably, and she radios dispatch, and who should take the call? Maddie offers it to one May Grant. She says, "Dispatch, rescue has arrived. I'm good." And she's like, "Copy, Mom. We're glad you're okay."
She doesn't say mom. She says 727 L30.
Exactly, but you know, it's implied. And she goes, "Glad you're okay." And she's like, "Yep." And that's it. And then small time skip.
Well, she says to Bobby, she says, "Thanks for coming to get me." And he says, always.
And then small time skip. There's a barbecue. Kebabs are on the grill. Athena is wearing this beautiful, like sort of, it's like a wine-colored blouse, I believe. Burgundy. Yeah, very, very nice. She looks great for having just survived that disaster.
And Harry, because the kids are here, Harry is wearing a similarly fashionable look that is that just says, "Hello, dude."
Do you think Michael picked that out for him? Or do you think that was just Harry himself?
I think it speaks to the child's sense that pretty much any text on a shirt is cool.
Yeah. Hello, dude.
I had the stupidest graphic t-shirts as a kid.
Oh, dude. Yeah. Yeah. Do you recall any instances? Because we're going to get comments.
I remember one I found at a thrift store that said, like, "I'm not short, I'm fun size," which is a funny shirt for a child to own, because it's like, yeah, you're not short, you're a child.
Mm-hmm. I would wear that ironically now. I would crop it and I would wear it now.
Right? Because you're like 7 feet tall.
Exactly.
I also, one time at Goodwill, found, I was probably like 9 or 10, I found this shirt that was, I believe, a Corona shirt. Like, it had the Corona beer logo on it, but I was a child, so I didn't understand that. I just thought it was like a cool design for a shirt. And my sweet mother, I think, allowed me to get it, despite having a beer logo on it. So shout out to Barb for letting me get the Corona shirt.
Shout out to Jane's mom. We know you listen to this podcast. Want to say thank you for letting her get that shirt. You've raised a wonderful daughter. I had some buffoonery that I wore, some buffoonish logo shirts. But I remember my friend had one that, like, it was just so perfectly 2012. We were in middle school, and she'd come to school wearing it. It said, "Who needs swag when you have Gangnam Style?"
That's too good. It's like a parody of what someone would think 2012 was like. Yeah.
That's another one that I would wear ironically now and, like, crop it and, like...
Yeah. Circled back around to being extremely funny again.
Exactly. Like, turn it into, like, some, like, slutty muscle shirt or something. I think that would be the look. And basically, it's a nice barbecue. Those kebabs look delicious. I love kebabs. Athena, she has a brief aside with May, where basically she still doesn't want her to be doing all that. It's a very sort of like mom-daughter conversation where Athena's like, you know, has this made you rethink anything like that? And May's like...
Yeah, she does such a like kind of low-key manipulative thing, parent thing, where she's like, "Wow, after the day you've had, I wouldn't be surprised if you wanted to just throw in the towel now." But May, of course, responds to this by being like, "You think I'm going to quit? Like, I'm not going to quit." You know, May says something like, "I know you don't understand why I took the job." And Athena's like, "Yeah, I don't." But finally, May reveals that which I thought this was pretty obvious, but I guess Athena hadn't gotten this yet, that May's like, I got this job for you. Like, ever since you were attacked and since Dad got a brain tumor, I have felt like more of a need to be out here helping people and keeping an eye on you and on everyone.
Because she feels very... Guys, say it with me now. Powerless.
Powerless.
Powerless. She feels powerless about what this whole year has been. And it has been a very power and agency robbing year with the whole Athena thing, the whole Michael thing. And of course, that little thing called COVID. And Sar, because of that, you know, May's, you know, inspired to take this job. I will say, when Athena is explaining, sort of like trying to break down like the shift in May, she's like, "You were so excited to go to USC. You talked about doing pre-law or maybe a journalism track." I was like, "Ooh," because for our Patreon subscribers, you might recall that in my season 9 pitch, it involved a deep workplace blood feud between Mae Grant and Taylor Kelly as they competed for recognition and success at their in their journalism field. So I liked to see seeds of that because I completely forgot that that was even mentioned at all.
Oh yeah.
Oh moms. Oh, parents.
Yeah. I liked even the note they ended this on, though, because they don't resolve it in this scene. You know, mm-hmm. it's like they still have this disagreement. So it kind of sets us up for this to continue for the rest of the season, which, you know, sometimes 911 has the problem of just resolving something way too early. So yeah. I liked that they kind of left this wound open for the two of them to potentially deal with later in the show.
Yeah, yeah, they let it linger for sure. Maddie comes home. She demasks as she steps through the door.
She takes off the mask at the end of a long day. You see the relief. She goes to shower. Mm-hmm. She sees that there's like a suitcase on the floor in the kitchen, mm-hmm. and she assumes, oh, that Albert, you know, so messy. She's like, Albert, you can't keep leaving your shit everywhere. She goes to take a shower, comes out of the shower, new shirt, looking great. Mm-hmm. And who should be there but Chimney Han?
Oh.
And listen, I find it so funny that because she walks out and Chimney is standing there in this like tight little black tank top, you know, muscular arms all the way out. And yes, mm-hmm. probably the implication is he just like also got out of the shower before she came or something. But to me, it says like he specifically wore his sexiest outfit to surprise his girlfriend that he hasn't seen in months.
And it's like, babe, I'm home.
Yeah.
You missed this, right?
Remember these guns?
And it's a very interesting reunion because it's not like one of those like just run into each other's arms. Oh, I'm so happy to see you. It's like there's a little bit of tension and like it's like why?
Yeah, they're not sure at first now? If they're mm-hmm. gonna touch or yeah, if they'll stay social distanced or not. Right. But yeah, Chimney's like, I realized that. Well, first he notices how pregnant she looks.
And she does, and she is. She's very pregnant.
She is pregnant. That is true. Mm-hmm. That's not a lie.
It's like, oh, I didn't clock this through the Zoom call, through the FaceTime.
To be clear, he knew she was pregnant, but he's kind of marveling at it had not fully visually registered to him over FaceTime
It's like an aha moment where like it becomes very real very quickly for him because he's kind of had it still as a somewhat abstract concept in his brain that oh he's gonna be a dad, right? And we see we learn the reason for this, the why of this. He mentions that like the world is changing and like I need to change, right? I need to stop running from this because I got really stressed out and freaked out and overwhelmed and I ran and I abandoned you and I'm sorry and I was so scared that I'm gonna be what my father was, etc. And it's time to be scared together.
And they like reach out tenderly and take each other's hand for the first time in months, and they're both crying and I'm crying. It's so beautiful.
It is. It's very beautiful.
Maddening.
This is why Maddie is the best couple on the show. This is why Maddie will endure for years on end.
Maddie endures.
Maddie endures. Love endures. Okay?
There's this kind of interesting moment after that where we go back to the Grant-Nash household and Athena and Michael have a moment in the kitchen. Michael says he's getting ready to go and Athena's like, really, so soon? Because of course he'll be taking Harry with him because Harry lives with him now. But Michael is like, you know what, maybe we should let Harry stay here tonight because, you know, I know you miss him. And then there's kind of a weird moment where I didn't fully get what they were getting at this point, if it was, but basically Athena is like, is everything okay with David? And Michael's like, you know, like, I know you think we moved in too soon, together too early, but whatever, it felt right. And Athena's like, no, I'm just worried he doesn't look like he's getting enough sleep. And that's like the end of it. And I was like, is that supposed to be just like, is the emotional beat supposed to be Michael being like, oh, she does care? Or is it supposed to be like some kind of innuendo? Like, she thinks he's like keeping him up too much at night. Am I crazy? I couldn't really tell what the episode wanted me to think at this point.
I couldn't tell either. And this was confusing to me because let me tell you why it got even more confusing, because we go from that to Michael, right? Michael being wife of the year, giving David the absolute princess treatment by, running the shower.
Yeah, he's like setting up the shower.
He's putting out this beautiful dinner
mm-hmm. with the two glasses of red wine.
Mm-hmm. He's putting on this decontamination bag for David's laundry so he can wipe the COVID off of him. And he's going to take care of him. I don't know what they were getting at here, because we get this it's intercut with Eddie and Chris in bed on Zoom with Carla. Hello.
He's reading them a bedtime story.
Reading them a bedtime story.
Assuring Christopher that even if they can't see each other in person, he can mm-hmm. see her whenever he wants on the computer, which I love how brief of a moment this is, because it kind of seems like the show was just like, oh yeah, in case you forgot that Eddie exists and he has a son. They're
and
still
Chris has braces now. Chris has braces now, because I think Gavin had braces now.
He's pretty cute.
And then it's sort of intercut with David getting home. Michael's like, gotta disinfect my man. And then, David, he gets in the shower. David's actor is ripped, by the way. He's a very beautiful man. And he comes out.
Michael got very lucky when he was trapped on the elevator with this guy.
He really did. He lucked out. I wish I could, sorry.
Well, it's what I said when that episode happened, is I was like, how lucky for the both of them that you just happen to be stuck on this elevator with a hot and also gay man who like is your type, is about mm-hmm. the same age as you, like so many variables, and it worked out. So good for them.
And then he comes out of the shower. Michael mm-hmm. is setting up this beautiful dinner, and This bothers me. This, because the act of physical touch here, it's so chaste.
I've heard people talk about this before, that bizarrely this couple never actually like kisses throughout the show, which I had honestly never really noticed until
they
people
never
brought
kiss.
It up. I will say, I'm going to be very generous here. This was during COVID, and it's possible that there were certain things that were not considered as safe to do on sets this early on during the pandemic. I don't really know what the rules were, because obviously they're still getting close to each other. They're not having to be socially distanced or wear masks in scenes like this. But I mean, I noticed it with Bobby and Athena, too. We didn't actually see them like kiss or even hug when they reunited, I don't think.
But they still wrapped their arms around each other.
Do they? Okay. I guess I'm just saying it's possible, because we don't see anybody kiss in this episode. It's possible that maybe it was they just weren't doing that because of COVID.
Okay, but then we also never saw Michael kiss Glenn, and we also never see Michael kiss David throughout the rest of his time on the show, which extends another year and a half. So I'm like,
not to be out of pocket, but I'm going to make an out of pocket joke. You know how Rockman Dunbar is a member of that new agey religion that doesn't allow its followers to introduce foreign things to their bodies?
Oh, my
Maybe
God.
Men are considered foreign objects.
Penetration
no vaccines,
of any kind,
no piercings,
whether by needle
no tattoos,
or something
no
else.
Men.
Right.
No homosexuality.
Exactly.
For legal reasons, that was a joke, and I mean no offense to the Church of Universal Wisdom.
Jesus Christ. But this is like a question that I have, because the chastity of this relationship, it goes completely like unexamined throughout the rest of their time on the show, and it also never changes. We never see their acts of intimacy get more I don't know, personal. I mean, presumably they're having sex at this point in the relationship. They've been living together for six
You're
months.
You're not saying you need them to have a big, crazy sex scene. You're just saying it's kind of weird how chaste they act together all the time. I mean,
well, it's like, do you remember that backlash to the first season of Modern Family where all of the couples kissed except for Mitch and Cam? And so in order to
address
that, they had them kiss very softly, briefly in the background.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely something to be said for like... gay couples on TV sometimes not being afforded the same kind of, because again, we're not asking for like crazy sex scenes from these characters all the time. Like that's
it's a
not
problem
really in
with
line
this
with...
show. It's a problem with Henren. It's a problem with Buck Tommy.
Yes,
it's like,
blessing in disguise. But so... yes, I have felt that way about Hen and Karen before, where it seems like they hardly ever kiss and they... At first, it seems like they almost, whenever them having sex is even alluded to, they'll like be interrupted in the act or like some, they like don't actually sleep together until like season six, I'm pretty sure, which is kind of wild.
They've been married for this long. They were saving themselves for the sixth season.
And then I guess Buck Tommy, they made a valiant effort in that one episode to imply that they slept together, although... Let the record show that Buck wakes up fully clothed.
Fully clothed. Fully clothed.
So we actually don't know that anything truly happened.
We like see them make out. And but that was also, that was after the whole like sort of summer break long hashtag let Buck fuck campaign. Because everyone was noticing how weird and chaste the Buck Tommy relationship was. It's not the weirdest thing about that relationship, but it is. It was weird. It was like I mean, you remember we went off on that, you know, back during 806.
The Halloween episode was very bizarre when they're not even sleeping in the same bed. They're like in Buck's living room for some reason.
But Tommy's like had a bed made up on the couch. It's so weird. We'll get to it when we get to it. But
so I guess you could say that this show has shown maybe a bit of a bias against showing their LGBT couples specifically being more physically intimate together. Like I said, I am willing to give them the benefit of the doubt for this particular season because it's possible that they were less free to do stuff like that because of health and safety. But I guess we'll see how the season progresses. If anybody else smooches each other, we can start to call out the hypocrisy.
Yeah. And so we'll leave it at that for right now. There is a very funny moment at the end of this little wrap up sort of intercutting thing where we cut back to Eddie and Chris on Zoom with Carla, and Carla's bedtime story has not only put Chris to sleep, but Eddie as well.
Yeah, it's pretty cute.
It's very cute. And then we see Henren, the doctor arc mentioned, and little Nia is there and gives Hen her little unicorn as a good luck charm for her test.
And little Nia can already use full sentences, which is crazy. Like in the last season, she was like fully a baby. And now she's like, here for your first day today. And you're like, whoa, that's a whole child now. But anyway, Hen is sent off to school by her wife and foster child. And it turns out school is just walking across the room to sit down at her laptop and get on Zoom.
It's like a comedy beat. It really is. Yeah. And it was giving me major flashbacks because I did college in COVID for a year and it was not fun. So I remember this vibe, Hen. I remember it well. And then we see back on Zoom,
yes.
How the turntables, because Albert is now sleeping on Buck's couch. Couch theory.
Which, yeah, this yaoi, like...
This yaoi? Are you kidding me?
I'm kind of shocked that there's not a bigger, like, Buck and Albert ship that was born out of this, because I was like, oh my god, if they made, like, Buck and Eddie COVID roommates, imagine.
Oh my god.
And also, I mean, let's talk about this scene, because they start talking about it, you know, they're like, how are you liking living with Buck? And Albert's like, you know, there are kind of a lot of rules, like Buck wants me to do chores and stuff. And Buck's like, come on, that's not that bad. Albert has this interesting line where he says, I contribute in other ways. I was just running with it. I was like, yeah, tell us what you mean by that. But he says, like, I make a great cup of coffee or whatever.
But again,
but I wasn't thinking
that's a
about
euphemism.
That.
That's a euphemism.
Totally. It feels like one. Finally, we see this little thing where Buck gets a call and we go back to this idea of like, oh, Buck has this secret girlfriend. And Maddie's like, come on, stop being so secretive about your new lady friend. I want to meet her. But Buck runs upstairs to his room. Now, How do you keep this a secret when you live in a loft apartment that by definition doesn't have walls separating the rooms? But apparently he's keeping it a secret from Albert and previously kept it a secret from Chimney. He gets up to his bedroom and answers the call. It's not his new girlfriend. It's his therapist. Mm-hmm. He's having a therapy session. And he mentions, like, I've been thinking about what you said about how I hide my feelings from others. And I think it's true. And the therapist's like, okay, let's start there. Which I have to say, I believe this is setting up like our Buck Begins arc. But yes. If I were watching the show live at the time and like were a buddy shipper at the time, I fully would have thought Buck saying he hides his emotions from others was the beginning of his queer arc.
But it does read like that. Like I wrote down in my notes, like, you fucking bisexual.
It be like the final cliffhanger of the episode kind of makes it feel very significant, you know, which makes it feel like, oh, what's this mystery going on with Buck? Which, of course, you could say it's the Buck Begins stuff. But yeah, mm-hmm. If I were a buddy shipper at the time, I would have like freaked out, which honestly, kind of glad I wasn't, because then, you know, little would I have known that I would have waited like four more seasons and still... Still, I guess he would have had some queer awakening, but Buddy would still not be on the front burner, as it were.
No, but at least he's in therapy. Everyone should be in therapy. Yay therapy. He has those government benefits.
It's almost time for Buck 3.0.
Almost time. But in the meantime, one last little moment in Maddie and Chimney's apartment, because Chimney feels the baby kick for the first time.
That's right.
And then that's it.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like this was such a slam dunk. Like I said, I was impressed at how much they fit into this episode. We mm-hmm. had so much character stuff going on for Madney. We had Athena essentially overcome her apprehension at coming back to work through this. In both cases, like, they came to those conclusions with their internal conflicts through the external conflicts that were happening, which is always so great. They're really knitting the character, like, you know, sometimes you'll hear 911 fans be like, I don't like the disasters, I just want character stuff. Or maybe you'll hear people go, I don't care about character stuff, I just want disasters. And it's like, what you guys don't understand is that a good episode of 911, a good season of 911 should knit the character stuff into the disasters.
Exactly.
That's how it's supposed to work.
You are supposed to have both, because they feed off of each other and they work together to create an interesting and compelling story for these little chickadees. And so because of that, yeah, I agree. This episode was a total slam dunk. I really enjoyed it. And it was a great sort of affirming moment of like, oh, season four is just going to be like wall-to-wall bangers, I hope. I've said that before, but I'm really looking forward to the rest of the season, because, you know, we get the Buck Begins arc, we get another arc that we love so much, and we get like a bunch of stuff that is really beloved in the fandom, and I'm really looking forward to
some great individual fun and games episodes.
Yeah,
and somebody left in our comments for last episode, because we had mentioned that versus some of the other season premieres, these ones aren't terribly Buck heavy, and you had mentioned, you know, kind of missing the Buck heaviness, but somebody commented about how they actually like that this was a Buck light episode, and I have to say I think I agree. I not that I would like want him gone forever, but I think not having the stuff really focus on Buck in any way kind of made it feel very fresh and new.
That's
versus
true.
Maybe mm-hmm. the last couple openings.
That's true. You have to be careful with how you use him, because he can sort of overpower things in a certain way and kind of draw focus.
Mm-hmm. He's like truffle oil or something, you know? You put just a little dab of him in the soup and he'll overpower everything.
Yeah, no, I agree. And so I, in reflection on that, after having seen this sort of payoff here, I am happy that it was kind of a Buck light episode, because I also feel like they're saving the really great Buck stuff for later in the season. And that's my boy. So I'm just excited to see it. How do you think the play-by-play recreation of this episode is going to work for season 9 in space?
Ooh, that's a great question. Because, yeah, when we were covering season 2, season 8 was also airing. And we had some great, interesting parallels that ended up coming out. I would be very curious to see if we have a similar experience. you know, maybe Athena in space will be kind of like Athena trapped in the house, and there will be some sort of, you know, maybe the character played by Mark Consuelos will be kind of like the Sylvia character.
Ooh.
And Athena Jonah has to get them both out of the whale.
Yeah. From space.
From space. We'll see. You know, maybe Buck will be back in therapy or something. Or
maybe we'll get like a hen delivering a child from a pregnant astronaut
in space.
In space.
An alien child from an alien.
Yes. Yes.
Well, I believe the actors who play May and Harry were upgraded to main or mm-hmm. regular or whatever status yeah. this season. So I do wonder if we'll get, I don't know that May would start working as a dispatcher again, but I wonder if we'll get some sort of parallel with either her or Harry or both.
May is an astronaut. That's how Athena got the ticket. May is like, come bring your mom to work day.
That would be great. But I wonder if we'll see like a similar, like one of Athena's kids stepping into a first responder role and how Athena deals with that and how the kid deals with that. Maybe we'll see kind of a parallel there. But yeah, I guess we'll find out.
We'll find out. So I guess all we can do is wait and see. I am very, very okay. So like I've mentioned where I am emotionally with this show a couple of times on the podcast. I was texting my, cause I'm getting texts. I'm getting DMs from a bunch of friends who know that I have this podcast, and they're all like saying, Ryan, what now? What is she doing in space now? Why is this happening? And like, I don't know. I don't know. What do you want?
Yeah. Do you think we write the show? We wish, but we don't.
How should I know? My pitch had nothing to do with this. Well, that's not true. That came later in the storyline. We didn't start there.
Yeah.
And so I'm very excited to sit down because I know that the entire internet will now be watching just to see how and why and to what end. And that'll be a nice communal experience. I like that, you know, as the season premieres get more and more ridiculous, it ropes in viewers who don't stick around, but it maintains yeah. enough interest in the show in sort of a broad sense for it to keep getting renewed, leaving them to just continue floundering.
You know what else could do that, Tim Minear? Buddy Cannon.
Yes, that would get you front page on Pink News for weeks. Weeks.
Maybe not even just Pink News. Maybe you could score like a Variety or Hollywood Reporter kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, the sky's the limit. And anyway, thanks for listening to this episode of the First Respondcast, everybody. Yeah. By the time we come out with this episode, we should have our next Patreon bonus episode out, which is this month a sort of fandom autopsy. We kind of just went through like all the things we wanted to cover in terms of the fandom. It got pretty funny. We unpacked some of our personal Twitter beef. It's a fun time.
It's a fun time. So head on over if you want to hear that. We have a few other bonus episodes on there. We're actually building up a pretty healthy catalog. So if you want
and
more
by
of
healthy,
us,
we mean four.
four. And so if you'd like more of us, check that out. And if you want to support us further, follow us on social media at First Risk Podcast, spelled how it sounds. And just remember, guys, you know, going into this season 9 premiere, if you ever feel alone, just know that you are alone together.
And help is not coming.